I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Key provisions of the Patriot Act just expired on Monday morning at 12:01, about 2 years after Edward Snowden exposed the NSA's domestic data surveillance program. It was a feisty session in the U.S. Senate on Sunday when Senator Rand Paul took on the Republican leadership, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The Senate will be debating the House's USA Freedom Act today, but it's not clear the House is going to buy any changes to the bill. Our guest is Manu Raju, senior congressional reporter for Politico, has been following this debate. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
So how unusual was the Sunday session?
It's very unusual. First of all, they don't ever really work on weekends, let alone Sundays, let alone Sunday evening, and 8 hours before a major deadline when a law was set to expire, at least three key provisions of that law. And it really was a Republican-on-Republican battle, and it was largely a Rand Paul versus the rest of his party battle. Most Republicans wanted to extend the Patriot Act, as it's currently constituted, at least the Senate Republicans did, three provisions in the law that are set to expire, including the very controversial provision that the NSA has used as authority to collect bulk phone record data from the telephone companies. And that was set to expire at midnight. Rand Paul stood his ground, and he said that he would not consent to any extensions whatsoever, not even a short-term extension of the law, and not even a bipartisan House-passed measure that ends to overhaul that bulk data program that Rand Paul believes went too far. In the end, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell really was backed into a corner and had to accept that House bill, which he also opposed, but because he believed it would constrain law enforcement too tightly on intelligence gathering matters. And he ultimately accepted the House bill, but he couldn't move forward because Rand Paul was still standing in his way. And it really led to a lot of tension internally, and it's really had an impact on Rand Paul as he prepares for his presidential run here.
Well, let me just put a couple of quotes out there. This one is actually from John McCain talking about Rand Paul. He said he obviously has a higher priority for his fundraising and political ambitions than for the security of the country. Mitch McConnell talked about disinformation and demagoguery. Rand Paul said some of them, I think, secretly want there to be attack on the United States so they can blame it on me. I believe Rand Paul walked that back a bit. But, this is very personal and obviously very highly charged.
Yeah, you really don't see this kind of personal attack being leveled between members of the same party. And it's actually kind of interesting because Rand Paul actually is someone who's pretty popular among the Senate Republicans over the last 5 years, despite having views that are that they're out of the mainstream of the Republican establishment. He does have maintained a very good relationship, particularly with Mitch McConnell, his fellow Kentucky senator, as well as the Republican leadership, senior veteran Republicans, because he doesn't really rock the boat. He may express his opinion, ask for votes, but he doesn't really bring the Senate to its knees the way he's done right now. And that's really what's changed things. Republicans, a lot of them believe that he's doing this, he's taking such a hard-line stance, in which he knows he's going to lose, simply to boost his presidential prospects, to improve his fundraising, which he's been aggressively fundraising off of his fight, including his 10.5-hour filibuster on the Senate floor about 2 weeks ago. So this has been really aggravated a lot of Republicans who believe that Paul is simply doing this just because he wants to show voters that he's fighting the Republican leadership, not because he actually believes it's going to change the outcome on Capitol Hill.
But it seems that Senator Paul has been pretty consistent on this issue. Do I have that right, Manu?
Yeah, that's correct. And to be fair, that is 100% true. Rand Paul has, from the beginning, wanted to get rid of the Patriot Act, has fought for it. He's a libertarian-minded senator. He argues that the Patriot Act infringes on constitutional rights of privacy. He has done that from the beginning of his term. I would say what's different now is the surprising about his refusal to allow even a short-term extension of the law to go through for about a day, a week, 2 weeks. That's something that he has not necessarily stood in the way in front of before, at least not to the extent that he has now. And that is what surprised people, because the Senate is a place where any one senator can really drag out the process, can slow things down, and to get – things moving. There needs to be a lot of cooperation. And when one senator takes a stand like this, it really can throw a leadership strategy into flux. And what makes it particularly interesting now is that he had thrown his own party strategy into the flux, and he's really embarrassed his fellow Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader.
And why did Mitch McConnell hold this meeting on the Sunday? I mean, just hours before this was set to expire. They were on vacation before that. Was that a mistake on his part, do you think?
I think it was a big miscalculation from McConnell from the beginning. Last work period, this is a six-week work period before the Memorial Day week-long recess, there were a bunch of pieces of legislation that McConnell had to get through. He placed a big priority in getting the Trade Promotion Authority through. That's a fast-track trade bill that would move to the lead to the enactment of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That took a couple weeks in the Senate, probably longer than McConnell wanted to, but he had prioritized that instead of the expiring surveillance laws. And so by waiting to the end of the session to move on the expiring surveillance laws, it allowed Rand Paul to say, I'm not going to let you move forward. And it made McConnell make a choice. And, okay, do I scrap the recess, which no senator wanted him to scrap the recess. They all wanted to go home, vacation, campaign, whatever. Or do I bring the Senate back early and just see what happens if I bring back the Senate back early? Maybe I can get a deal on the Sunday before the law expires. And he decided to bring the Senate back early, and clearly that didn't have any impact whatsoever.
Is Senator Paul persona non grata in the Senate? You wrote about a meeting, I guess it was held on Sunday, that Paul did not attend. I don't know if he was invited or not, but you describe members of the Senate berating Senator Paul, Mitch McConnell kind of sitting silently. How significant do you think was this meeting?
It was pretty significant because, you know, it was held in the Senate Strom Thurmond Room, which is where the Republicans tend to gather when they have to hash out big strategy sessions. And, you know, senators had just come back from vacation. They were meeting about what they're going to do going forward. And Mitch McConnell basically laid out that he was going to cave. He was going to accept this House bill, the so-called USA Freedom Act, that's moving through the Senate today. He said he was going to reluctantly accept it. He could not get Rand Paul to agree to his demands to allow at least a short-term extension. That short-term extension, McConnell argued, would have allowed a deal to be cut between the House and the Senate, something that would be more palatable to Republicans in the Senate. And Republican senators were very angry at Rand Paul. He was definitely invited. All Republican senators were. He just decided not to attend, probably because he knew that his colleagues were furious at him. And there was just a lot of anger being leveled at Rand Paul. Dan Coats, the Indiana senator, stood up and said that he believed that Rand Paul was lying about the Patriot Act in order to further his political ambitions. And so you heard this level of acrimony being leveled behind closed doors in a pretty surprising manner.
So have Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, have they kissed and made up yet?
I think it may take some time. Yesterday on the Senate floor, Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, they chatted. They had a cordial conversation, we were told. They joked about Matt Bevin, the Kentucky gubernatorial candidate who challenged McConnell unsuccessfully in the Senate primary last year. They had a nice, light moment. But soon after, McConnell went to the floor to try to speed up the votes, had the votes yesterday. And who objected? Rand Paul did.
Wow.
And having the votes today. So they may be better on the personal level, but on the policy side, they're still on complete opposite sides.
So what should we know about the USA Freedom Act? And this is the act that was passed by the House that's going to be debated by the Senate today.
That's right. It basically what it is it changes a few different aspects to put more safeguards on the NSA's spying program. And essentially what it does is that in the current system under the Patriot Act, the NSA collects bulk metadata from telephone companies, telephone records, American telephone records, and by collecting that data, they can presumably track patterns and track how suspected terrorists are talking about communicating, etc. Of course, that has led to the privacy concerns, civil liberties concerns. This was revealed by Edward Snowden 2 years ago. The House bill would change that bulk data program so the telephone companies keep those records, not the NSA, not the federal government. Now, the NSA could still access those records by obtaining a secret court order in order to actually do the same kind of surveillance that they're doing right now. It would also add some new safeguards to the secret court known as the FISC court. That actually provides some of these classified orders. So it does some safeguards like that. Rand Paul argues that this would actually continue the spying program and actually would lead to an expansion and codification of what he believes is a unconstitutional surveillance act. But he's in the minority on this. Very few Republicans and Democrats agree with him on that matter. And on the other side, Mitch McConnell believes that it would actually make it harder for the intelligence community to gather information. They don't think keeping it at the telephone companies is the right idea. And then you throw in another variable. The Senate, Federal Appeals Court last month actually struck down or said that the Congress never authorized the NSA to conduct the bulk data collection program under the Patriot Act. So you have all these different dynamics, these different bills, and these different views that have made it so difficult, particularly on the Republican side, to come to some sort of consensus on moving forward.
And I heard a report on NPR this morning that House leadership are saying to the Senate, don't make any changes in this USA Freedom Act. We want it just as it is.
Yeah, and that's really going to be an interesting development today. We'll have to see how that turns out. Among the changes that Republicans in the Senate are seeking, they want to change the transition period from this current system of the where the records are stored from 6 months in the current USA Freedom Act to 12 months. And so that would essentially allow the current program to continue for a year if the Senate Republicans were to have their way versus 6 months, which is if the House Republicans were to have their way. There are a few other changes that they're seeking as well, but that is largely an effort by Senate Republicans for sort of a face-saving measure, if you will. They had to swallow this bill that they initially opposed, and they want to try to make some changes so they can argue they made the bill better. But if they do make those changes, the House may not accept them. So it'll be an interesting fight between the two chambers that are, of course, run by the same party here today.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. We haven't talked about the Democrats. Are they just playing a backseat role to this whole debate?
Yeah, it's been interesting. They largely, by and large, are supportive of the USA Freedom Act. That's why you haven't heard much about their role in this. The White House is supportive of that bill as well. Very few Democrats are on Rand Paul's side that want to either repeal the Patriot Act outright or oppose the USA Freedom Act. Two of them are Ron Wyden of Oregon and Martin Heinrich of New Mexico joined Rand Paul in this effort, but no one believes it would have went to this length if Rand Paul didn't take the stand that he did.
Well, Manu Raju, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Anytime. Thank you.
You're very welcome. He's senior congressional reporter for Politico, has been getting us up to speed on what's been happening in the U.S. Senate over the last 2 days related to the Patriot Act. We'll take a very short break, and then we have two more guests who will be joining us carrying on this conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. The provision of the Patriot Act that allowed the government to keep tabs on our phone calls has expired. I was just talking with Politico's Manu Raju about this contentious battle that began in the Senate on Sunday. It continues today, and it's a debate over whether this program was a violation of privacy and civil rights, as Senator Rand Paul says, against those who see it as a valuable tool in the fight against terrorism. We have two guests who have joined us as we carry on this conversation. Mattathias Schwartz is a freelance journalist based in New York. He's written about the NSA program for The New Yorker. He's also been published in The New York Times Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, The London Review of Books, Bloomberg Business Week, and numerous other publications. Mattathias Schwartz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here. I'm actually a staff writer at The New Yorker now, but I think that changed since last time I was on. But no, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And now we just promoted you to staff writer. Also with us is Jennifer Granick, Director of Civil Liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society, where she practices, speaks, and writes about computer crime, security, and electronic surveillance. I should add that she was the Civil Liberties Director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm really screwing up my intros today. And Jennifer Granick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's no mistake that people often make exactly that error of saying freedom instead of frontier. So it makes a lot of sense.
It does. But we like both freedoms and frontiers. Matt, let me begin with you. What is different? I mean, it's now July 2nd. What is the sort of before and after when it comes to this 215 provision of the Patriot Act as it stands today?
You mean now that it hasn't been renewed?
Exactly.
Now that it's supposedly gone dark. Well,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone really knows. I mean, I don't think you sort of have this image of a blackout where there's a giant NSA building collecting all the phone metadata suddenly going dark. I don't think that's true. There are provisions in Section 215 that allow the NSA and FBI to continue metadata investigations that they've started before. They can certainly continue to query the 13 years of data that they already have stored under Section 215. So what is perhaps different is now phone calls that we've been making, say, for the last 30 hours are no longer authorized under Section 215 to be collected into an NSA database. Now, are they perhaps authorized under some other provision of the law? It's very hard to say. But I think there's a bigger picture. You know, some civil liberties folks have said that this isn't such a big deal, but I think this is the first time that we're really seeing Congress push back on the idea that that national security can justify most anything that the intelligence community asks for, and they're saying that you need to make your case and you haven't made it, and we need to start to dig into the details. So the small picture changes may not be so great, but to me the big picture changes are very interesting.
Well, Jennifer, just picking up on what Matt said, and you know, why don't we know? I guess why don't we know about what has changed or not?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. One of the things we've really learned, the most disheartening thing we've really learned, is about how much what our government does in our own name is secret, from secret laws, secret interpretations of laws, secret rules. And so we still don't have a very clear idea of what the intelligence community is doing with these legal authorities, what they think the limits are, and how they operate. So we are not sure whether they think that even though Section 215 is expired, they can continue to collect this data. We know that there are other legal authorities under which they might be collecting this data. And I don't think we know the majority of types of investigations or types of data that they're using these legal authorities to collect. So, you know, despite the fact that the Snowden disclosure started about 2 years ago, there are still a lot of unanswered questions that I think Congress and the American people really need to know before we can start formulating what we can count on as being sound reform policy in this area.
I mean, Matt, this expiration comes sort of on the heels of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. They ruled unanimously that this Section 215 of the Patriot Act was illegal. Does this in certain ways give it a death blow to it, or it just sort of reconstitutes itself?
Again, all we're talking about is the collection of phone metadata and apparently some other kinds of data under one provision of the Patriot Act. And it's possible that this data could be collected through other means, even if, USA Freedom Act passed, which a lot of pro-civil liberties folks like Senator Leahy have been pushing for. This data would still be collected by the phone companies. The government still would be able to query it. There'd be a few more checks and balances as far as the FISA court orders that authorize that querying, but we still wouldn't have a complete picture of what was going on. The data would still be there, and the government would still be able to get it under certain circumstances. So I think calling it a death blow might be something of a stretch. But Congress is certainly rolling up its sleeves and taking a more active role. It's also complicated and so enshrouded in a dull and technical language that I wonder sometimes how well, some members of Congress may understand it themselves.
Well, Jennifer,
I totally agree with that, Matt. Although my opinion about the Second Circuit opinion is that it could be quite far reaching. And that's because it interprets the meaning of the word relevant in the Section 215 statute. And the way that the intelligence community and the FISA court had secretly interpreted relevance was to allow the agency to collect all Americans' phone records. And what the Second Circuit said is that relevance doesn't mean that. Relevance is much more narrow than that. You can't do a dragnet under a relevance standard. And there are so many other surveillance statutes that have a relevance standard, whether it's the statute that the DEA was doing their phone dragnet under, or the statute under which we know that internet metadata had been collected. So I think that the reasoning of the Second Circuit really reaches a lot of other provisions, some of which are also addressed by the USA Freedom Act and some of which aren't.
My understanding, and having done previous shows on this, is that even some of the authors of this 215 provision of the Patriot Act said the way the NSA has been using it was not their intention. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's what Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, who is one of the sponsors of the Patriot Act, has said.
I mean, which of course raises questions about why this is such a huge debate, I guess, in the U.S. Senate. And that's what I was talking with Manu Raju about. Matt, do you see this bill that's coming from the House as a fix for the Patriot Act, this provision of the Patriot Act?
I think it's very hard to say. I mean, I think the putting a special advocate inside of the secret FISA court, which is the court that it will interpret all of these rules and has interpreted them up to now. So far, at the moment, that court is one-sided. It's not an adversarial process. The government speaks and the judges rule. The House version of the USA Freedom Act would add a special advocate who's there in theory to speak on behalf of civil liberties. Now, the process would still be secret, and there's a question of whether that person would just wind up being a creature of the system or not. But I think that's a very significant change. Mm. And shortly after Snowden's disclosures, President Obama appointed a board called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, the PCLOB, which had existed before, to look into the Section 215 program and also a couple of other surveillance programs. And they've produced a lot of interesting reports that have really driven this debate and have debunked some of the NSA's early claims about how useful the Section 215 program was. So I think the PCLOB is an example of how these new organizations and groups appointed by congressional statute, you know, even if they do come from Washington and come from the intelligence community, can actually shed light on things and make something of a difference.
Jennifer, do you think this can be reformed and changed, or should it be just completely tossed out the window?
Well, I think it should be completely tossed out the window, at least until we have a lot more information. You know, I think that there's something that's very fundamentally wrong with the role that the secret FISA court is playing. It was initially established to review questions about whether particular targets were legitimate targets or not. And of course, it makes perfect sense that that's something that you would want to have done in secret, because you don't want the targets to know, the terrorists or the foreign agents to know that, you know, you've got this case against them and this is why you think that they're worth listening to. But what's happened is that the role of the court has metastasized since September 11th, and now they're issuing all these rulings on both statutory and constitutional interpretations. And these rulings are the things that are defining, in secret, top secret classified opinions that are defining the civil liberties of Americans. We don't know what they think the Fourth Amendment means. We don't know what they think these statutes mean. We don't even know what definition of American, U.S. person, the FBI uses. So I think that we need to, you know, sort of start from a first principles and go back. But I think that, you know, Marty, you've put your finger on something very interesting. And Matt, I'll be curious to hear what you think about this, about why it is that we're having such a vicious fight over the USA Freedom Act and this particular thing. I mean, by all accounts, USA Freedom Act is pretty mild reform. The NSA themselves have said that they support passage of the act. So Director of National Intelligence Clapper and others have said we support passage of this act. And yet you have these surveillance hawks in the Senate who are trying to weaken this bill even further. And you have, you know, other people in the Senate who say, like, now that it's sunset, let's leave it sunset and not do anything. I think to some extent the discussion about the phone records collection is a focus point because it's so shocking that I think to some extent it's a little too narrow. There's got to be reasons why this is so important that we're not really speaking about, because the phone records surveillance is only part of what the government's doing under Section 215, and it's only a small part of the overall domestic collection that the NSA is doing with this and other legal authorities.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jennifer Granick. She's Director of Civil Liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Also with us is Mattathias Schwartz. He's a staff journalist based in New York, writes for The New Yorker, and we've been talking about what many people are talking about over the last couple of days, and the fact that several provisions within the Patriot Act have expired, at least temporarily, raising a whole host of questions about civil liberties, about national security. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be taking calls in just a couple of minutes to find out where you stand on this particular issue. Matt, let me go back to you. You had a long piece in The New Yorker, of course, known for its very long and very interesting pieces, about a U.S. citizen born in Somalia. He was actually living in San Diego, is in prison now. But I guess as an example of at least one case where there was the use of some of these phone records, but your article raises questions about whether how necessary that was and whether there was another way that this particular person could have been identified.
Yeah, that's something that that some senators have said that there could have been another way to identify this individual whose name is Basali Mowallen, and who was convicted of material support for terrorism. And so in a technical legal sense, he's a terrorist. But the legal definition of terrorism has expanded a great deal since 9/11. And what Basali Mowallen was convicted of doing was sending $8,500 with the intent that it reach the Shabaab, State Department designated terrorist group in Somalia that is, organized very many, vicious attacks in Kenyan malls and takes captives and hostages and so on. But this is the only case in which the Section 215 program has led to the identification of an unknown terrorist suspect. The only time that collecting hundreds of billions of phone records over the course of 13 years has found, arguably, a single person inside U.S. borders with any connection to terrorism. And it's certainly not the next 9/11. It's certainly not even a violent terrorist plot that was going to take place in the United States. It wasn't a good thing, but it was the provision of funding to an overseas group. And the fact that this is the poster boy, this is the hook upon which the intelligence community has sought to hang, a massive collection of data. To me, I find that very striking. That they don't have a stronger argument.
Well, and going back to something that was said before, Jennifer, I believe there were two independent panels set up to investigate this provision of the Patriot Act. And it seemed like at least one of them said that it had not been abused, but also they hadn't seen much benefit coming out of this particular provision. Can you weigh in on that?
Right. Both the President's Review Group, which President Obama appointed after the Snowden disclosure started, and the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, or PCLOB, great name, have reviewed the phone dragnet under Section 215, and both of them have pointed to abuses. I mean, we actually have a declassified court opinion from the FISA court detailing the ways that the NSA and FBI, basically just completely blew off the rules that the judges had placed on their use of this program for years. But also they looked at the question of whether this program is useful, whether it's efficacious. And both of those groups said no, that it hasn't been useful at all. One of the things I think is really interesting about that is, you look at the Mullen case and the provision of material support to terrorists, like that's the only case that they really can point to. And you wonder, when they first asked, when the press first asked the NSA director at that time, General Keith Alexander, about how useful this program was, he said, oh, there's some 54 plots. Upon inspection and inquiry, it was rapidly discovered that that was just not true. And basically, this was the only case they could really come up with, which suggests.
And let me just interject. The president even said it once in January 2014, he said more than 50 plots. So he was even using this rhetoric. I'm sorry, please go on.
No, that's fine.
Yeah,
that's
no,
fine.
Thank you. And I think that, that means one thing. It means one of two things. It means either they're not telling us the truth in order to sort of get that meme out there and have that be the number that people keep repeating. And certainly you hear it on the Senate floor even today as they're debating it, you know, we need this authority and this is very useful, or the inside the intelligence community, they don't really have a good sense. They don't really have a good metric for how to tell whether these programs are working or not. And I think that's really scary because, you know, not only are these programs posing dangers to people's civil liberty and invading Americans' privacy, but they also cost a heck of a lot of money. And if we're operating these and they're not really, you know, we're not really getting our bang for the buck, that's really something that we need to know.
And about a minute before we have to take a break here, to you, Matt, and this is something that you wrote about, I mean, is there a need for some kind of a church-style committee hearing which investigated some wiretap abuses by the government going back a couple of decades ago? Are we at that point yet?
Some people are making that argument, folks from the Brennan Center, people who were involved with the original church committee. And I think it is a good point that the 2 years on from Edward Snowden releasing one secret FISA court opinion that points to just one little corner of what the intelligence community is doing, no one has really pointed their flashlights anywhere else, with the exception of a couple other Patriot Act Section 702 program. But there's so much else that's going on that no one knows about. And you would think that the gap between what this program says it does and what Congress's understanding of it does and what it actually does would prompt the asking of some broader questions about how the intelligence community operates, what other authorities it might be using to gather other data sets. But no one's really taken up that mantle. And I think that could arguably point towards a need for some kind of broader investigation. But first, someone would have to have the political will to appoint such a body. It doesn't really look like that's likely to happen anytime soon.
Well, I do want to take a very short break, and I do want to talk about Edward Snowden and how we should think about him. That's Mattathias Schwartz. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, has written a fair amount about the Patriot Act and various provisions within the Patriot Act. Jennifer Granick, again, Director of Civil Liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. You've had a chance to listen to the conversation. We want to hear what you think. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jennifer Granick and also Mattathias Schwartz about the Patriot Act, and I do want to talk about Edward Snowden. Just a quick email from WM. He says, I congratulate Rand Paul for his determination. The so-called Patriot Act is actually an act of fascism slopped together by paranoid fanatics of the George W. Bush administration. I have to say that there have been some Democrats, Matt, who have been supportive of the Patriot Act.
Yeah,
including the president of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. It's had a lot of. It's very hard to argue against the threat of a possible future terrorist attack. It carries a lot of political weight. I think one arguably mistake that President Obama's made is telling people that, you know, and he said this repeatedly, that there isn't a trade-off between security and liberty, and that you can have both. And I think at a certain point, it does become a trade-off. And that's one reason that this current fight in Congress is so vehement.
Jennifer, let's talk about Edward Snowden. It is about 2 years since he revealed what he did about the Patriot Act. How do you see him? I mean, he's been described as, you know, a traitor, a patriot, a hero, a whistleblower, a criminal, an enemy. How do you see what he did?
To me, Edward Snowden's a hero. Period. I mean, I am a surveillance lawyer. I have spent my entire career not knowing what the law really was. And if that doesn't scare people that this is a democracy and we didn't know what the law meant, that we didn't know what the government was collecting on us, then I think you're just not paying attention. I my daughters call Edward Snowden mommy's friend, Edward Snowden. So I think he's a real hero. But I also think that, you know, sort of this focus on Snowden and who he is and what he's like and what his motivations are and, you know, sort of the saying he did this or that or he gave information to the wrong people or all that, you know, I think people don't really have a good idea of who he is. And that was shown when John Oliver did his great thing on Last Week Tonight, where he met with Snowden in Russia. But first, he interviewed people in Times Square about who he was, and almost nobody really knew who he was. They were all getting him confused with Julian Assange or thinking that he was more generally a spy. And I think that that shows that that rhetoric against him, you know, sort of really works. And that's a distraction. I mean, it really distracts people from the task at hand, which is to understand better what kind of information is being collected about us, how it's being used, and, you know, whether we're comfortable with that and if we want to change it.
You said you describe him as a hero. Does that mean he should come back to the United States and have clemency and be allowed to live the rest of his life?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the closest analogous person we have to Snowden is Daniel Ellsberg, who gave the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and to other newspapers. And, you know, we have to remember that Ellsberg was prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And it was only because of some government screw-ups in the case that the charges were dismissed. And then by the time that all happened, the climate, the political climate in the country had changed about the Vietnam War and about the anti-war movement, and the Department of Justice decided not to refile charges against him. So I think that history will look more kindly on Snowden than many people do now, but I do think that we need some time in order to really understand and digest what we've learned from him before society will make a sober judgment about, you know, what his legal fate will be.
Matt, how do you see Edward Snowden?
I think Jennifer's right that the documents he's, you know, revealed, what they contain is so surprising and so important that it doesn't matter if they came delivered by passenger pigeons or if they were, you know, downloaded to some trollish hacker by an insane, you know, or troubled, you know, military person, you know, which is, you know, the WikiLeaks story. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be therapeutic for the U.S. to reconcile its law against the disclosure of classified information with its requirements for probable cause and for the particularity of warrants. Which the disclosures seem to prove or show have been significantly compromised. And, you know, under what terms that will eventually happen, you know, I don't know. I know Snowden has expressed a desire to return to the United States. And, you know, to me, it wouldn't be too surprising if you saw some sort of negotiation between him and the government that allowed him to come back maybe during the next presidential administration and face, there would probably be some kind of trial, I'd imagine. But who knows what the exact terms would be or how it would turn out.
Interesting. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499, talking about a number of things, including Edward Snowden, some provisions in the Patriot Act that have expired. It's unclear exactly what their fate is, and it is to be being debated in the U.S. Senate. Let me see what Rose from, looks like Flemington, has to say. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
I would like to bring up the whole issue of Cynthia Rawley of the FBI, who had lots of data and was sort of poo-pooed out of existence and eventually ended up on the front of Time magazine. She sort of faded into the dust. The question is, if you have somebody as credible as her saying there is a problem, and she's doing this without this whole big laundromat of data. We have to ask ourselves, what did this really cost? Or was this really just a way of getting that military-industrial complex laundromat running at a greater efficiency and speed? I don't have to tell you, if you do a lot of wash and you take out the towels and the sheets to begin with, you don't have much time to sort out the socks.
Well, let's move beyond the laundromat here. But, Rose, you raise an interesting question. And if I can maybe toss that back to you, Jennifer, this goes back about a decade or so. But this was a woman who worked for the FBI and had some serious questions.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen other whistleblowers come forward to tell us that the FBI and the NSA are collecting information on Americans. You know, there was William Binney, Thomas Drake, AT&T technician, Mark Klein. There's been a lot of people who've been coming forward and telling us this is happening. And we've seen news reports on this, too. The New York Times published a story in 2005 about saying, you know, we're warrantlessly wiretapping phone calls inside the United States. USA Today reported on the phone dragnet. But what the difference is that none of these people had the documents. And so the intelligence community was able to minimize, divert, discredit, and basically kind of shut down the conversation. And that was what, you know, the approach was this time, too, with Snowden and his disclosures, except this time reporters had the documents. So we had evidence that what the intelligence community was telling us was not the whole story. Right. And so now we know, you know, not just about this phone record, Dragnet, but about all this kind of metadata collection, content collection, you know, massive overseas surveillance that affects, you know, not just regular foreigners, but Americans, too. And we have this information because we've got these documents that Snowden procured.
You know, I wonder, Matt, whether we are so used to being surveilled, whether it's our shopping habits, and it's clear, you know, if you're shopping online, it's somebody's watching you because you see the things that you're interested showing up as you go from page to page, or GPS or other forms of technology, whether we're just kind of have given up and are sort of used to the fact that, that someone is watching us. And that's that's what it's going to be like in the 21st century.
I suppose you're right in some ways that for a lot of Americans, this surveillance is innocuous and undetectable and apparently harmless, and the risks that it poses are hypothetical. But if you're a Muslim U.S. citizen looking to travel overseas, or, you know, if you're a Muslim living in America, particularly in a larger city, it's not hypothetical at all. And one thing that we haven't seen anyone do is compile a database of false positives, which we would need, you know, who are the people who've been wrongly accused because of false leads that have been generated by these authorities, which collect, you know, vast amounts of data from completely innocent people. And to really understand, do a cost-benefit analysis on what are we gaining and what are we losing with something like Section 215, that's something we'd have to know.
But is it easier, Jennifer, to track people's movements, to get their information just because of the technology we have compared to the kind of pre-internet days?
Well, certainly. I mean, nowadays, just by living in modern society, we're generating all kinds of information. I mean, when you read the newspaper, there's no record made of it. But when you read the newspaper online, there's a record. There are log files generated. When you walk around on the street, you know, there's no record of that unless you're carrying a cell phone, in which case it's pinging all the cell towers as you go. So there's certainly a lot more information being collected, but I don't think that's a reason for people to kind of throw up their hands and give up. You know, we have other tools to protect people, including, you know, both technology and law that can protect people from privacy invasions. And I think that, you know, as the technology becomes more powerful, the law actually needs to become more protective to ensure that sensitive data doesn't end up in places where it's going to be abused.
I mean, does the Fourth Amendment still apply, Jennifer?
The Fourth Amendment definitely applies.
Just checking.
But exactly how, we still don't know. And that area of the law is fascinating and it's really developing. But I think one thing we've seen as a trend is that the Supreme Court isn't just sitting there, you know, sort of mechanically applying 1970s and 1980s era cases to what's happening today. The Supreme Court justices are acutely aware that the kind of information that's generated about us and the surveillance capabilities today are, you know, markedly different from what happened in the past, as different as, you know, the difference between riding on a horse and taking a rocket to the moon, I believe was the quote in one case. So I think we're really going to see the Fourth Amendment law explicitly develop to cover some of the things that people are frightened about now. Of course, we're always capable of doing better than the Fourth Amendment through statutory protections. But the thing the Fourth Amendment law is slow to evolve. It requires bringing a case before the court, and for a variety of reasons, including secrecy and misrepresentations from the government about where it gets the information it uses in criminal cases, we haven't, you know, the Fourth Amendment law is going to develop more slowly. And that's why there's just a really important role for Congress to play in reining in these practices.
Matt, we have an email from Carol. She says, when these phone calls are readily available to NSA employees, isn't there always a temptation to just read one or two of them just to snoop? But I want to understand, because this is really data collection. We're not talking about the government actually listening to phone calls. And this has been raised several times related to this particular provision. Can you clarify things for us?
Under Section 215, that's correct. The government can acquire the records of when phone calls have been placed, who they're to, where they're from. And it also can collect things unrelated to phone calls, including certain email transaction records, credit card information, hotel information, rental car information. That's all according to testimony from a Department of Justice official. And these parts of Section 215 have gotten a lot less attention than the phone metadata. Now, there are a lot of legal ways that the NSA can collect content of communications, but Section 215 is not one of them.
Something you said earlier, Matt, looking at the way, I guess, the Patriot Act is written, is that the language is kind of dull and kind of uninteresting, using words.
Well, the words phone and metadata are not in there.
They're not. What do they use instead?
Let's see. I think it provides for the collection of business records through a court order that are relevant to an ongoing terrorist investigation. And then I think in the actual FISA order, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, it refers to the bulk collection of tangible things. That's the primary order.
Tangible things.
And then only when you get down to the secondary order does it become clear that when we're talking about business records and tangible things relevant to an ongoing terrorist investigation, which sounds like a certain thing, we're actually talking about Verizon turning over on an ongoing daily basis metadata from every single phone call made by every single subscriber in the United States. Now, how you square that with the Fourth Amendment's requirement that warrants spell out the particular places and things to be seized, I mean, that's a stretch, and a lot of paper and a lot of legal hours have been spent by the government, you know, trying to square that circle. But to a lot of people, and to me, it's very hard for that to make sense.
Jennifer, I mean, can we say this was written in a panic? It was shortly after September 11th, or written to really obfuscate what the government wanted to do?
I don't think so. I would say more, you know, it was these provisions, you know, the Intelligence Committee and the Department of Justice, they're in this for the long haul, and they have these provisions and these issues that, you know, they have, you know, they move from the front to the back burner depending upon political considerations about whether Congress and the American public are willing to accept it or not. Mm. You know, and I think there's, you know, this provision was written for certain. Section 215 was written for certain reasons, but then, you know, after USA Today revealed that phone companies were illegally disclosing phone records, massive amounts of phone records, I think the phone companies balked because there's legal liability for doing that, and they needed some kind of order compelling them to do so that they wouldn't get sued by their customers. And that was the point at which the Bush administration concocted this argument that they can get bulk phone metadata under Section 215. But I think the emailer points to the woman who emailed points to some other serious considerations, which is, you know, what about abuse here, and what are the safeguards? And I think there's two kinds of abuse. There's the abuse of people who are inside the agency who peek or who use the records for their own purposes. And certainly this has happened. It's actually happened so often that the NSA has a joke name for it, which is Love Int, sort of for love intelligence. And there's been lots of situations documented where people looked up who their spouse or their ex-girlfriend or whatever was calling. And then there's the more, you know, sort of official abuse where there are rules or regulations or limitations on how the information is supposed to be used, and those rules are violated, and that's happened too.
Well, you know,
it's not just with phone metadata. There is content. You know, and the idea we're collecting content, massive amounts under other provisions. And computers listen to it. You don't need to have somebody listening to your phone calls anymore. You have computers with voice recognition or, you know, searching tools that look through your emails, and computers parse through everything at this great speed. And
I got to jump in here. I hate to do this, Jennifer Granick. I hate to do this only because they're playing my song. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And Mattathias Schwartz, thank you very much as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Very important discussion. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.